across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the podcast this morning, the portrait at Belfast City Hall that's been damaged by a former employee now of Sinn Féin. Dennis Taylor joins the programme today. Him and Steve Davis are coming back tomorrow. Can you remember all those years ago? Some of you weren't even born. Anyway, all coming up on the programme this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. So more pain for Sinn Féin. Under pressure this morning after one of their employees helped to smash up a painting of the former DUP Lord Mayor Wallace Brown. You couldn't make this up. Sinn Féin are telling us that the employee has been immediately suspended, the police notified. We then hear that the party have told us that this employee who worked in the Assembly has now resigned from their party and their job. The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, saying that he doesn't know if the motivation was sectarian bigotry, anti-Semitism, wanton destruction, or a mix of the three. He says it's a disgrace. The DUP councillor, Dean McCulloch, with us this morning. What did they do to this portrait, Dean?
So, good morning, Stephen. To my knowledge, the portrait was ripped from the wall and smashed. I have not had sight of the portrait, and we are awaiting a full report as to the extent of the damage.
Was it taken off the wall?
It was taken off the wall, forcefully.
Is it big?
It is big. So it would have been quite a task, Stephen, to take it off the wall.
Now, how do you feel about this?
It is a disgrace, Stephen. It is even more disgraceful that it was carried out by a now former employee and member of Sinn Féin. Belfast City Hall is a shared space. We promote it. Such there are portraits that hang throughout the building and the tell of the story of City Hall and its people. They are a great asset to the city, to tourism. So the fact that someone, a former Sinn Féin employee and party member, at an event organised by an Irish language group, would see fit to rip down a portrait of one of our former DUP mayors and smash it is an absolute disgrace and is something that has done real damage to relations.
Relations between who?
Relations between parties in City Hall, namely our party, and relations across the city, Stephen, because
Lord Brown was a
well-respected politician, not just within unionist communities, but within communities across the city. He was a man that showed everyone across our city respect, and sadly, that same respect was not reciprocated.
But why should it affect relations between you, the DUP, and Sinn Féin? You can't hold Sinn Féin responsible, can you, for one employee's actions? Your party should know that as much as anybody else.
Well, when did Sinn Féin know about this? So we initially made inquiries when we were made aware that the portrait was taken down. Subsequent to those inquiries, we called for a full and robust investigation. There is now a police investigation, as I understand it, which we welcome. The story then broke on the news, Stephen, and then, and this is important, Sinn Féin released a statement. Did Sinn Féin know on Saturday night? Did they know on Sunday? Did they know on Monday? When did they know? Who knew? Were there witnesses to this? So we have asked for the CCTV in the vicinity to be reviewed. We would like to review that CCTV. But the question that needs to be asked now of Sinn Féin is, when did they know?
Why does it matter when they knew? They've said that this person was immediately suspended and Sinn Féin told the police. What more could they have done?
It matters when they knew, Stephen, because the statement was released after we had called for a full and robust investigation, after the media had reported on the ripping down and smashing of Lord Brown's portrait. So did Sinn Féin know on Monday morning? And if so, did Sinn Féin furnish Belfast City Council with the information that they had?
Well, very little moves in that City Hall without Ulster Unionist Party Councillor Jim Rogers knowing about it. So what damage, Jim, has been done to this portrait? Was it punched? Was it kicked? What happened to it?
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I think my colleague has given a very fair report on exactly what did happen. Now, I'm on Belfast City Council over 30 years, and I don't recall any portrait being defaced, never mind badly damaged. Nothing like that has ever happened. And I'm disappointed, I'm sad that something like this should take place. And I'm glad that the individual who was involved in it has been shown the door, basically, as far as Sinn Féin's concerned. But we need now to review the use of the building that we have in Belfast, one of the nicest buildings throughout the United Kingdom, if not Europe. So it's important that we establish maybe a much stronger protocol on how you can get the use of our City Hall, because this is going to cost a lot of money to repair and replace, and I'm just sickened and disgusted. And the person in question, Lord Wallace Brown of Belmont, you couldn't meet a nicer person, an absolute gentleman, a man who was a brilliant
Lord Mayor. Is he alive or dead?
Oh, he's alive. He's serving in the House of Lords for
right.
the DUP.
Okay.
So we need to get on top of this. Do we install security cameras throughout the City Hall building? That's something we're going to have to carefully look at, because we can't have this happening every other week or every other day. We need to get something done. And our security staff do an absolute first-class job. Make no mistake about it. But people can't see everything.
And Jim, can you just help me understand what was done? Is it just the glass that's broken? And I don't mean just to minimise this. I mean, can it be repaired? Is there more fundamental damage done to the portrait? What has happened?
Well, I've been told that there's a fair amount of damage been done to the portrait, but it can be repaired.
The actual painting destroyed, is that
well,
right?
I'm not going to go into that. I don't think it's right or proper to go into that at this stage, because the police are involved. And I welcome Sinn Féin taking action, because that's important, because we're trying to build relations in the city of Belfast, regardless of a person's religion, colour, class or creed. And I don't care who the person is. If they are going out to damage, then we have to review security. We need to take action, and hopefully this will never, ever happen again.
And is there CCTV wherever this was hanging up?
Stephen, I'm not going to go into that, because these are security issues.
Oh, for goodness sake, Jim, it's not a security issue whether there's CCTV in the corridor it was in. It's not like we're not talking about nuclear secrets here.
No, I'm not prepared to go into that. Our security staff will take care of that, as well as the council directors, with our support. But I think it's just shameful. And let me repeat, in all my years in Belfast City Council, I don't remember even graffiti written on the glass of a portrait.
Is this this is one individual within Sinn Féin. Do we know if there were other individuals? Councillor White, Carl White from the SDLP joining us. Carl, do we know if this was just this one Sinn Féin, unnamed as far, employee? Were other individuals involved? Do we know?
My understanding is just one individual, Stephen, but as your other contributors have said, there is an investigation now into this, which I'm sure will come to the bottom of the episode. And that individual who has resigned should apologise for what they've done. That portrait is not just a portrait of Wallace Brown. That's a portrait of the office of Lord Mayor of our city, a city which we all love, we all represent. And I've said this before in your show, Stephen, while we may not agree about Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland, the Belfast identity is not contested. There's a lot of rich tapestry of stories that make it up. And I think it's important that person apologises for what they did. Jim is right about Lord Brown. The reports are that he's very affable, nice guy. Certainly doesn't deserve to be reading headlines like this. But this isn't the first incident in the City Hall at night time. A couple of years ago, I received footage of a flute band marching around the City Hall in the middle of the night, playing sectarian tunes. And there was an investigation then, didn't really go anywhere. I hope this City Hall investigation that we have does go somewhere, because there's clearly an issue about being able to walk around the civic home of our beautiful city at night time and able to engage in vandalism and
You also don't want to make the City Hall unaccessible, do you? It needs to be as accessible as possible, as open as possible, does it not?
It does, and I was in yesterday in meetings, and there were tourists walking into the room to have a look. You know, it's great how people freely walk around the City Hall and enjoy it, and everyone in the city has a lot of respect for and likes going to visit it. But you know, this is not the first incident we've had late at night in the City Hall after an event. And I'm not saying we're not going to turn into Fort Knox, but there might be a security guard or two having a walk around when people are leaving the event.
Dean McCulloch, is this an isolated, no party can control any one individual incident? Or is this indicative of a tension, of an anger that there is in Northern Irish politics at the moment and in Belfast City Council? What's your take on that?
So that is a question, Stephen, that you would need to ask Sinn Féin. Gavin Robinson, our party leader, asked, I think, the apt question, which was the motivation behind this. What was the motivation? Was it sectarian bigotry? Was it anti-Semitism? Was it wanton destruction? Or was it a mixture of the three? But this happened, Stephen, within a context, and that context is Sinn Féin scandal after Sinn Féin scandal. The previous contributors, who are my colleagues on Belfast City Council, have made the point. There have been a whole host of events. All of our parties have attended events. We have sponsored events, but we have shown respect to each and every portrait that hangs within Belfast City Hall, because that Belfast identity and the office of Lord Mayor is critically important, and that, at the very least, ought to be respected. Unfortunately, on this occasion, that respect has not been reciprocated by a member of one party.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get here, and I'll ask the same question of you, Jim Rogers, is there any sense of a heightened tension in politics at the City Hall? And obviously we're going to look later in the programme, is there a tension, is the honeymoon period over between the Shinners and the DUP, or Sinn Féin, the DUP, in Stormont? What's it feel like in the City Hall at the minute, Jim?
Relations have been very good and continue to be very good, and it's up to us as elected members to ensure that we don't end up disagreeing, because it wouldn't be in the best interest of the people who pay their rates month by month or year by year. And I would hope that this would be an isolated incident, but we needed a follow-up. We need to get an official report and take it from there. But I work right across the council. I'm not interested in who's who. We're there to serve the people, to make sure that their hard-earned ratepayers' money is used to the best advantage.
But we need
action, and I'm aware that already that is in force. Our security people are moving very quickly, and hopefully it's not going to end up in a free-for-all or in an argument or a row between us and other parties.
We're interested in a little tidbit, Carl White, just to share this with you. We believe that the first time the police were aware of this was after Sinn Féin contacted them. So they initially told us, this is the police, they initially told us that they had not received any report of any damage to this portrait in the City Hall. And they then confirmed that they received a report at 10 to 5 yesterday afternoon, after the Sinn Féin statement said they had reported it. So the question for me is, why did the City Hall administration not report it?
Yeah, that is a question, and that's news to me, and I'm sure news to other councillors. I will be asking why that report wasn't made to the police, because I'm sure that their City Hall authorities were aware of what had happened much earlier than that.
Stephen, could I...
Because the statement, sorry, Dean, the statement from Belfast City Council to this programme said police received a report of criminal damage to artwork in Belfast City Hall at around 10 to 5, Monday 21st of October. You see, that wasn't received from City Hall. It was received from Sinn Féin, and Belfast City Council confirming that a report, it was reported to have occurred, this damage, sometime on Saturday night. So why is the council not reporting this immediately?
Well, I would be rather surprised if that wasn't the case, because normally if there's something of a serious nature occurs in our buildings, the police are contacted asked to come and look and decide.
Well, why don't
what
we clear it up?
Take.
We'll get in touch with the City Council right now and we'll try to clear it up within the next few minutes. Go ahead, Dean.
So we made an initial inquiry, Stephen, to our chief executive and city solicitor. So to be fair, they had initiated that morning their initial inquiries. They had spoken to the group concerned and they were making those relevant inquiries. So to be fair, they were in the infancy of an initial inquiry. We have now then called for a full and robust investigation. But Stephen, I want to be very clear this morning. You have posed a number of questions to yourselves, questions that we cannot answer. Have you posed those questions to Sinn Féin? Where are Sinn Féin this morning?
Well, you know.
Sinn Féin are the party that can answer those questions, and the questions that we have as a party, were Sinn Féin representatives in the vicinity? Because we know there were Sinn Féin representatives at varying levels, the most senior levels, in fact, of the party at that event. So were there Sinn Féin representatives in the vicinity? Did anyone from Sinn Féin witness this? When did Sinn Féin become aware of this? These are the questions, Stephen, that need to be directed towards Sinn Féin. And no more, I talked about the context of this in the midst of scandal. No more half-truths, no more apparent cover-ups, as we have seen in other instances in recent weeks. We need full truth and full accountability from the outset on this, Stephen. So our call is for Sinn Féin to come forward and to tell us what they know and when they knew it.
Now, while I have you three on, can I just ask you about a separate matter, starting with you, Jim Rogers? Are you concerned about what local business is saying in recent weeks about the traffic gridlock around Belfast city centre and the potential impact on people deciding whether to venture into the city to shop at Christmas?
Yes, absolutely. And I haven't met anyone who hasn't been complaining. It's very badly organised, and I would be in the city centre of Belfast most days of the week, and it's been a nightmare. Hopefully they're going to get it right. And it's the same with the Sydenham bypass, nightmare there, but they've made some improvements, and long may that continue. It's not easy. Hard Street especially, and Great Victoria Street, they're all busy thoroughfares, particularly for buses. And it's up to us as elected members to continue dialogue with the transport company to make sure that we can get this working properly.
You're running out of time, aren't you?
It'll be for the benefit. It'll be for the benefit of everybody in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and further afield.
Carl, it's the 22nd of October. You're running out of time.
Yeah, there's urgent steps need to be taken, Stephen, by the DFI minister. I think that the opening of Grand Central should have been a real switch-on moment for people in Belfast to switch to public transport. And I think, unfortunately, it has really been an event that is just people now associate with traffic gridlock and chaos. I saw it firsthand before the Boyne Bridge was closed, a red light which stayed red for nearly 10 minutes, and nobody really did anything about it. Your colleague Mark Simpson was there as well. So, yeah, it's absolutely... it's chronic gridlock every day, and the solutions that DFI are bringing forward aren't being brought forward quickly.
Well, Dean McCulloch, let me fire this question at you. It applies to all the parties on the council, for example, but Carl is leveraging the responsibility on John O'Dowd, who's the infrastructure minister, and you can understand because he's the infrastructure minister why he's doing that. But are you all as a council sitting down urgently and working out what levers you have as a council? So if there is a disincentive, Dean, for people to come into the city centre this Christmas, are you contemplating free parking? Are you contemplating doing something extra this Christmas to try to help these businesses who, the likes of Chris Souter, who represents, you know, the thoughts of some of the business community in that area, he said some businesses could go to the wall here. So are you urgently contemplating any levers?
Well, first and foremost, Stephen, we are urgently calling upon the Minister because it is the Minister's ultimate responsibility and his department.
You lot are in charge of Belfast City Council. Well, you're on it. You're sitting on it.
To look at this urgently, Stephen, we are looking at a whole host of initiatives to draw people into the city
like
centre.
What?
And to be fair...
What is there?
So, our Christmas market is a prime example of that, Stephen. We are looking at a whole host of events, so we are now working with our business sector and other private partners as well.
But how does the Christmas market help all of those businesses that pay rates all year round and now have a competitor dropping in December?
Well, Stephen, it's proven. And the data is there that the more people that we bring into the city centre, the more benefit there is on local business. So it's critical that we have people in the city centre. That is why we are looking at pop-up events in Victoria Square, making other parts of our city more attractive in the city centre, investment. But fundamentally, Stephen, if people cannot get in and out of the city centre without there being chronic gridlock, chaos on our roads, well, then that is going to discourage people from coming into the city centre. Us, as a council, we have been looking at those incentives to actually bring people in, but we are not in control of roads, so we are calling upon the Minister. We want to work with the Minister and his department proactively and urgently to resolve this matter before Christmas. But let me be clear, Stephen, attracting people into the city centre, which the Christmas market does, which other markets do, looking at our nighttime economy, we have been calling for the department and the Minister to act as well in terms of transport.
Well, he's paused the works, hasn't he? He's paused some of the works from 25th of November, it is. Jim, I asked that question about free parking, but there's more complexity behind that question because, of course, the whole initiative of central government is to disincentivise people from using a motor, to get them out of their motor. In fact, there have been prominent people over recent times. Chris Conway was telling people to get out of their car, increase car parking. So what would your thoughts be, car park charging, Jim? What would your thoughts be? Do you give free parking this Christmas, or do you increase the parking to get people onto the buses this Christmas?
Well, you've got to do a number of things, Stephen, and I don't think the right to give free car parking, that's a throwaway line. But in saying that, you've got to bear in mind that the City Council are not responsible for car parks. It's the Department for Infrastructure and other organisations.
Oh, that's back to O'Dowd, is it?
Yes, that would come under his bailiwick. So we all need to work together in the interests of Belfast.
Are you worried?
Yes, I'm worried. I'm concerned. And I've spoken to a number of businesses and they're deeply concerned because they realise that in the 3 to 4 weeks on the run up to Christmas and the 2 weeks after Christmas where the January sales get underway, that's their lifeblood. That's where they need to get the money in because other parts of the year are not good. But Belfast is a great city and we'll get over these matters.
I'm going to Amsterdam for my wee Christmas market.
Well, it's a good idea. You wouldn't be staying in County Down, unlike a lot of us. But that's another story, Stephen. But it's all about us working together in the interest of the capital city of Northern Ireland, Belfast. And I have no doubt about it.
If he hadn't been so cheeky there, Councillor White.
Working together is the key.
If he hadn't been so cheeky, Councillor White, he might have got an invite to come with me.
Well, you would be the last person that I would want to go with. No harm to you, Stephen. Even with complimentary flight tickets and train tickets and bus tickets.
Now, Jim, you be careful, or I'll have to expose our wee trip up at Templemore Baths when you were in your wee bungee smugglers.
And you've still visited Templemore Baths. And I'm putting out an invitation for you to come and see it, because it's absolutely magnificent.
I can't get that sight out of my mind. You put me off. But I'm being told behind the scenes here it is amazing. So maybe we'll go up and have a wee juke. Okay, Councillor McCullough, Councillor Rogers, Councillor White, thank you. 0330 80 55 55. What day is it? Tuesday. We'll take your calls this Tuesday morning after the news from the BBC. Michael's at Warren Point. Good morning, Michael.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
Just wondering, portrait, who pays for the damage? Is it the guy that broke it, or is the ratepayers going to foot the bill for that one?
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, because when we were growing up, if it broke something, we had to pay for it, or our parents, one or two, you know.
So what are you saying? Are you saying should the individual employee from Sinn Féin offer to pay for it? Should Sinn Féin offer to pay for it? Should it come from the general fund? Is that what you're asking?
Aye, well, in my personal opinion, the guy that done the damage should be the guy that pays it, sir. You know, it's even if somebody breaks into your house, you have to then pay for your insurance. Well, should the guys who do the damage not be made pay for it? Maybe that'll be a bit of a deterrent for them.
Well, ultimately, a court can determine that if the police feel that that prosecution is necessary. You would tend to wonder how it wouldn't be if there's been damage to this. Unless, of course, it was unintentional, but there's no signal of that so far. Michael, thank you. Alex in Lisburn. Morning, Alex.
Following you, there's been a lot of discussion about Sinn Féin lately and the problems they've had with the behaviour of their members, and it's quite right. But I think the whole portrait thing has been farcical. You know, even taking the portrait down, those portraits are an historical record of who's been the mayor. I think the take it down sets the precedent. And what's going to happen with the DUP if one of their mayors is found?
This is Niall O'Donnell you're talking about.
That's correct. His behaviour was disgraceful, but he wasn't convicted of an offence. And the fact is, he was the mayor. And I think I just think this whole retrospective thing with taking down a portrait, it's foolish.
Well, Sinn Féin, of course. He was at the heart of Sinn Féin for a long time. They agreed it should come down.
Well, I think, well, they did, but I think if I had been in the DUP, I'd have been thinking, what happens if something happened to one of our mayors in the future? Will we be held? Will we have to take our portrait down? I think there's a lot of important stuff coming out in politics, and most of the detriment of Sinn Féin. I think this is a distraction.
Colin's in Derry. Morning, Colin.
Just 2 points I'd like to make. Jim Rogers there came on and spoke very well and just said it how it was and turned around and said, Sinn Féin, basically got their house in order, made a statement, and the person was put out of the party. Well, you had the DEP fellow on McCullough. He's coming on there, and he's just looking to tear strips off Sinn Féin as a party. At the end of the day, Sinn Féin made a statement. They got their house in order. The fellow was suspended, then kicked out of the party and put in the hands of the police for an investigation. So, in my eyes, criminal damage is done. The man has done the damage.
It's for the police and a court to determine whether it's criminal damage, but I get your point.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, he's not done that. He didn't do that there, or we're not aware they've done that on behalf of Sinn Féin. He done it on his own stupidity. So at the end of the day, why is the DUP member looking for Sinn Féin to come on to a public platform to have a debate about it? I'm not knocking you, Stephen, not knocking you, but again,
well, that's a change.
It's not a place.
I get the blame for everything. It's a wonder I'm not getting blamed for the portrait.
Your radio show. Wait, and I'm only saying, if you find out who the person was, And I don't just mean you beat BBC, UTV and all the rest of them. Why don't they go and knock that man's door and ask him the questions instead of asking Michelle O'Neill or other Sinn Féin members who may not have been there? It's not a party thing. He might have been a party member, but he was put out of the party. So I, DEP, that's helping DEP, Gavin Robinson saying, as a sectarian. Hopefully it's not, but they're just jumping on the back of a bandwagon. They're just jumping on the tail. Sinn Féin at the minute about cover-ups. Everything's, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, it was all about the DEP, MLA's meeting, LCC. So it's just, it's like a game of tennis.
Well, Alex Kane, former Director of Communications for the UUP, we were trying to get him this morning, we couldn't get him. He has said, I think we're likely to see on Twitter, he said, I think we're likely to see some new manifestations of instability within the executive, not to the point of collapse, perhaps, although I wouldn't rule it out entirely, but certainly very close to the cliff edge. The former DUP Special Advisor, David Graham, commentator, former SPAD himself, Brendan Mulgrew, with us today. Morning, Brendan. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning, good morning. Do you agree, David, with Alex Kane, that we're very close to the cliff edge?
Look, I think in all honesty, Stephen, we live right at the cliff edge in terms of the government stability and storm and stability in Northern Ireland, even at the best of times. I think one thing I'd say is that it's very difficult where, and obviously parties don't simply base strategy and policy on polls, but, you know, there's no doubt that the typical unionist voter, wherever they end up putting their number one or their X, the DUP TV or DUP, They like when the unionists, essentially in layman's terms, stick the boot into Sinn Féin. I mean, we know that it is a successful short-term tactic. We've seen it on lampposts. We've seen the, you know, we vote Arlene or get the Sinn Féin First Minister in recent times, etc. So I think the challenge is here where, on the other hand, it's quite clear from the polls that people like stability, they like the government to get on, they like that, you know, decisions are being made that are successful for all the people and benefit all the people of Northern Ireland. So it's a very fine line that Gavin Robinson and the DUP need to walk here, because, you know, ultimately I think they've taken the position of, you know, when your enemy is making mistakes, well, leave them to it and don't get involved. And I think that, you know, Sinn Féin clearly now are into at least their third week of self-inflicted damage. Whether or not we're at the end of it now remains to be seen. So I think, to go back to answer your question, you know, are we at the cliff edge? We probably are. But, I mean, Gavin Robinson has already said that he won't collapse Stormont on his watch, which I think is a difficult position to put yourself in, because you're basically saying, look, whatever you do here, lads, we're not going to pull the plug again.
But are we anywhere close, Brendan? Because I've spoken with quite a few people who say they have no sense of Stormont being close to the edge of collapse, as Alex was intimating, wasn't likely, but at least is now possible. What's your view?
I don't think that we are, Stephen, for a number of reasons. I think, actually, this time around, the sort of muted response that there's been between the two main parties when it comes to not taking the opportunities to really stick the boot into each other suggests to me that there's sort of an underlying stability. Now, what the motivation for that is another question. It's probably as much to do with the fact that the public like having the executive up and running, and the two main parties don't benefit from periods where it's down or where it's collapsed. And even if it's for that reason alone, I don't think we're anywhere near that point. And I think that point is illustrated by, you know, it's Timothy Gaston who's leading the charge in a more vocal and extreme way in the Assembly against Sinn Féin and the way they've handled their series of crises. Yes, some more senior DUP figures have begun to get more vocal. Taking David's point, that's probably in response to a demand or an appetite for that within some sections of the voter base. But at the same time, Sinn Féin have been quite muted when it came to DUP ministers meeting with the LCC. You know, that was left really to the SDLP in a sort of a pressure valve scenario to put the pressure on the DUP in their role as the opposition party. And Sinn Féin sort of stayed silent more or less when it comes to ministerial colleagues not criticising each other when there was an opportunity to do so. So the fact that the two main parties to date I think, are being quite reserved in their observations or their condemnation in the verdict comments of each other suggests to me that we are, I think, at this early stages of the of this up and running assembly and exec, I don't think we're anywhere near the point of collapse or even the threat of that.
Although, is the honeymoon period over, David?
Well, look, I think the honeymoon period, as you said, you know, there is a level where, and Brendan's entirely right, you know, there's a desire to say, look, we're going to have to try to make this work. And that's, you know, this is a wider point about having, you know, a multi-party system where we don't really have an opposition. I think even the SDLP are very clear or in a very sort of.
Well, they'd object to you saying that, wouldn't they? How do we not have an opposition if the SDLP is the official opposition?
Yes, but I think, Stephen, the problem with it is, and it goes back to my point earlier in terms of people wanting Northern Ireland to work, you know, the SDLP will be acutely aware that, yes, holding the government to account is very much their role. Matthew Toole in particular, I think, is doing a reasonably good job at doing that. But I think the challenge that the SDLP will have as well is if they are seen as being merely a criticiser of the government, that doesn't actually necessarily reflect well on them in the polls either. So, you know, this is a very difficult scenario. We saw the same thing when Mike Nesbitt and Colm Eastwood were together in opposition a couple of terms ago. It's not actually a particularly great position for success either. So, you know, as Brendan said, that there is clearly a sort of subconscious, conscious desire, if there's such a term, that, look, yes, we can sort of put the boot in here and there. And obviously, like, for example, Councillor McCullough was on this morning to say, oh, you know, this destroying the appendix is an awful thing, etc. But, you know, as Brendan says, it's not anywhere close enough to bringing the house down.
OK, interesting. David, Brendan, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55. Let's move on at 17 minutes to 10. Young people will stay in education or training until they are 18, under plans announced by the Education Minister, Paul Given. At present, young people can leave education at 16, which has been law since 1972. There are about 14,000 young people in Northern Ireland who are not in education, employment or training, about 7% of 16 to 24-year-olds, at a cost to the public sector of an estimated £134 million. This is what the Minister said yesterday at Stormont.
Participation in education beyond the age of 16 directly impacts upon life chances of young people. Regrettably, a young person's background remains a key factor in whether they progress to post-16 education. Compulsory education or training ending at 16 is a remnant of a manufacturing society with many unskilled jobs that no longer exist.
Well, the Irish News columnist Newton Emerson with us this morning. Good morning to you, Newton.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Kathleen O'Hare, former school principal, now chair of the Northern Ireland Skills Council. Morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning. So, Newton, the minister's now telling a 16 or 17-year-old the state is deciding that they will not go out and get a job like they might either want to do or need to do to pay bills into the family home. Is that protecting those young 16, 17-year-olds, or is that taking choice away from them?
Well, I mean, everything the minister was saying there is correct. I think the question is, will compulsion work? Now, they have this system in England. They brought it in about a decade ago, and there's no real controversy over requiring people to stay in school or training until 18. The point is that compulsion isn't really the rules aren't really that easy to impose. There are still about half the number of NEETs that there were. The apprenticeship system doesn't work. Employers find it very onerous. And so they brought the same law in at the same time in Wales. The Welsh government got the same powers, and it's decided so far not to use them. It thinks that you can achieve the same or a better outcome by just offering young people choices. So rather than requiring you to study one full day a week, as they do in England while you're working in Wales, they think perhaps it's better just to offer people, young people in work, more opportunities to get into training. And then you have the NEETs, the not in employment, nobody in employment or education. Now, they're quite small in number. You gave that figure of 14,000, but that's from 18 to 24. There are only a few thousand young people in Northern Ireland who aren't in school or training at all. And it may be better, and this is what the Welsh have decided as well, to offer them highly targeted help, maybe even cheaper, rather than imposing a blanket system that may not reach them at all. So it's not as straightforward as just imposing a mandatory late training age.
Kathleen?
Well, Stephen, I kind of think that it is probably a really good idea, but I want to see the outworkings of this. It's strange that Minister Girvan has actually made this announcement, because the authority over education 16 to 19 runs across two departments, the Department of Education and the Department for the Economy, and that's the one that looks at apprenticeships, etc. The 14,000 people who are not in education, employment or work, I think a lot more needs to be done for them than simply offering apprenticeships. There is a system where a lot of children, and Stephen, you will know them as well, a lot of children who are from families who traditionally have not worked during the Troubles, who have not worked because of the rundown of traditional jobs, they'll have to do a lot more to get those people into work rather than just pass a law saying you must go to school or training until you're 18.
I noticed, I think it was on your Twitter feed, you were having a pop at the grammar schools around this and why they boot out, I think it was using your terms, kicking them out is what you said, after GCSE in order to fiddle their league tables. Now help me understand what you were saying.
Well, this is one of the ironies of this report by the minister, which is in response to the Independent Education Review that was launched after New Decade, New Approach. And one of the review's recommendations is that schools are banned from removing children at 16, that all children will have a right to remain in their school or a suitable nearby sixth form if one isn't available in their school after 16. And you would imagine that an education minister planning to keep children in school after 16 would accept that recommendation to give them a right to stay in their school after 16. But of course, because the recommendation has put that in its section on selection, and this is a DUP minister, he's literally said in his response, well, this is controversial and there's no social consensus on selection, so we're not going to do this. So we have a report saying everyone must stay in school at 16, but at the same time, the minister's saying accept at your own school, which can kick you out. And I think that there's a case to be said that this is not selection at 16. Selection happens at 11. That's when our grammar schools say that they can identify children through an intelligence test by their aptitude, their academic aptitude. And if those schools then continue to kick them out all the way through at GCSE and AS level and so on, they're not living up to their educational duty. They're not delivering by their own ethos. They're just fiddling their league tables. And I think that it would have been, although the number of children affected is actually quite small, I think that it would have been an enormous symbolic difference for the minister to say, as of this point, once you're in school at 11, you have to stay there.
And when you're saying fiddle the league tables, I think I know what you mean, which is that part of how schools evaluate their own performance and whether they're the best school and all of this is about what percentage of pupils get the top grades of the cohort that's in there. So if they get rid of the weaker academic children, then that's how they are gaming.
But according to our grammar schools, they've already selected the academic children at 11 by their wonderful test. Yes, well, I know it's not a conversation about this. They've selected the academic children already. Yeah. So if they're failing to teach them and develop them and keep them in school, then where's this? What's the point of
that? Kathleen, I think it's really interesting territory, actually. And as a former school principal, what do you think?
Well, I have to say that, you know, and I don't agree with selection, but I wouldn't like to make this a conversation about selection. The minister did not say staying on in school. He said staying on in school or training. And I think this situation will be solved by more people staying on to 18. There are very few jobs that you can leave school today and go straight into. You need training, and that's in our FE colleges actually training providers. But there's no work that doesn't need training. And to say that the children won't be paid is wrong. Apprentices do get paid, and higher level
they don't get paid very much, do they?
Well, they get paid.
But just before we get on to that, Kathleen,
I
do want to speak about that. But just to address Newton's point, it's a whole other subject in its own, but I think it's incredibly interesting territory So just to address that, do you think schools should have the right to get rid of pupils age 16, pupils who want to stay at that school, have their friends at that school, have invested themselves in that school, haven't made the grades in one-off tests at 16, and they're booted out? Is that fair?
I think we need a better pathway approach post 16, and we do have a report which actually hasn't, the outworkings of that haven't been implemented. We do have a report saying that some schools have in sixth form a very academic education, and maybe that is not the route for everybody, but I think there's where better careers advice comes in, etc. to say,
but should have the school
pathway.
Have the
and
right
some schools have
should the school be required
because,
should the school be required if a pupil has been there from year one and they're now done their GCSEs, should the school be required to keep them until 18?
If a school has had the child until they're 16 and they have not done well, I would not be wanting to put a child in for two more years of failure. I would want them to go down some other form of education where they would have a success.
You call it two more years of failure. Why should the school not be trying to change those lower results into better results? Why should the school not be required to put more into those children?
Well, many schools have through collaboration with other schools, because some schools have a bigger choice post 16, better chances for success, and area learning communities make sure that a lot of students post 16 can actually get success. So, but I don't think this is ever going to be solved by the Department of Education. I think it's going to be solved by more skills training. We are crying out for workers at the minute. There are sectors which are really...
I'll come on to that, I promise. I guess just to finish this point, you can hear how interested I am in the subject you've introduced. The counter is that if a child hasn't done well at their GCSEs, maybe it would not be right to put them through the intensity of A levels.
Well, that's for them to decide. And as far as I'm aware, every grammar school in Northern Ireland sets an entrance test to go into sixth form. Some of them are really quite strict, maximum grades and the subjects you want to take on at A level and so on. But look, this is a small point. In this enormous report, really what we should do is scrap GCSEs entirely, because this is a legacy of the old senior certificates, the exams at 16. We don't need to have them. It's just an entrance test to A levels, which are an entrance test to universities. And that's the kind of thing that's going to be in the enormous curriculum review that's in this report. And the point made just there about training being under a different department. Well, another recommendation in the report is that there is one department for schools and training and universities. So we're embarking on this enormous conversation, but I think that it is a very bad start that the minister has just rolled over to this awful habit by grammar schools of fiddling the league tables.
And in terms of what Kathleen is saying, that we have this huge shortage of skills, Newton, is Minister Given right to say, well, look, let's make sure that our young people are being trained definitely for another couple of years at least?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, if you look at the apprentice system that was brought in about a decade ago across the UK, you'd realise how very difficult that is to deliver. By making more stricter requirements on apprentices and their employers, it's effectively caused the system to collapse, and it's almost impossible to stay in an apprenticeship now, because you have to be paid properly, or you get employment rights effectively. That's very difficult for, say, a lone trader to give to a young person. And so if there isn't massive help, although you're not talking about a large number of people, young people that are actually going to need this, if there isn't massive financial help for employers to assist this kind of training, and it's not going to work.
Kathleen, those young people that are out, for example, on an apprenticeship, I'm sorry I don't know this, and I should know it, do they get anywhere close to minimum wage, or is it simply a contribution?
Many of them are getting minimum wage, and most of them are getting above the minimum wage with other benefits. Because
are they legally entitled to a minimum wage?
That I'm not sure, and I will actually check out.
Okay.
But I have to say that employers are so keen to get apprentices. The difficulty is that Newton has actually said that it is actually cumbersome and bureaucratic to actually fill in all the forms for apprenticeships. There's another issue. If you look at all of our FE colleges, they have more people applying to be apprentices than they can actually fund at their colleges. And that's down to UK legislation, which is the apprenticeship levy, which has taken off employers here and given back as part of the block grant. And therefore, it's not ring fenced for skills training in Northern Ireland. And that needs to be addressed with the greatest urgency.
Bill's in Belfast. Morning, Bill.
Just a wee thing about this new rule we're thinking of bringing in. As you know and I know, at 16, 17, young people can get married. And they can have, if they have children. And if the two of these pupils are still at school, they have to bring the child to school with them. So the school then has to provide a creche. So the young girl brings it in for 3 days and her husband brings it for 2 days. So that's the girls' school and the boys' schools have to provide creches for these babies.
What's your point?
My point is the schools haven't got the money. There's no money. And yet they're going to have to set up a creche that would have to be run on very, very strict rules.
Well, what proportion of 16 and 17-year-olds, for goodness sake, being asked to stay in school, have children that are being brought to school? I would suggest...
Never heard of it.
I've never heard of it.
Well, I suggest you look up American television.
Look up American television. What do you want me to watch?
You
Quincy?
Can see it there. I'm only saying what could happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Watch American television. I must tune into Judge Judy. Big Audrey's obsessed with Judge Judy.
What is the statistics on young people under 18 having babies?
Going down massively every year.
Yes, but it's still happening.
Peter.
It's still happening and there is help to get childcare facilities.
In Babbridge.
But they're not provided at school.
Yes. Morning, Peter.
Hello, yes. Yes, Stephen. No, one very simple question, just tell, I think it's Paul, given to my name. If a stay a farmer's son wants to stay at home, is he compelled to go to school anyway?
He could do an apprenticeship,
but he couldn't just work for his dad and leave either training or education, could he?
Yeah, and that's just happened to my young nephew. Yeah.
Stephen.
Yes, Peter.
That sounds like a dictatorship.
That's what it sounds like to you, does it?
It does. If I have a son wants to work at home on my farm, and Paul Gibbons says he can't work with me, that's what dictators do.
He still can.
Well, he can, but it would need to be under a regulated apprenticeship, wouldn't it?
Like what?
Stephen, my nephew is doing a course in Caffrey at the minute and has actually proved even more helpful on the farm because actually he's going through a course and he's stayed on after his apprenticeship to do a level 3 course.
What's Caffrey?
Caffrey is at Greenmount. You would probably know it as Greenmount.
Oh, yes.
But it's now Greenmount, Loughrea, and in the southwest, they have horse equine studies.
Horse equine studies?
Yeah.
Okay. Each of their own. Peter, thank you very much. Newton, thank you. And Kathleen, thank you for coming on this morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Nolan Show today. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call. I don't know about you, but as I get older, I like thinking back to my younger days and some memories that are still locked in your minds. And how can this not be locked in all of our minds?
This is really unbelievable. Yeah! He's done it. Dennis Taylor, for the first time, becomes Embassy World Snooker Champion 1985.
And they're back. Dennis Taylor and Steve Davis once again coming face to face to play a match at the Dunadry Hotel. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Stephen. You weren't very old whenever that happened.
No, I was not. And I remember lying on my belly, which is not as fat as it is now, with my mum and dad in the house up Westway Gardens, young boy, watching that.
It's funny, the stories you get. I was with Ken Doherty there for a couple of days and we were down in Waterford and they were watching it in a shop, the whole half the street were watching the shop window and suddenly the TVs went off around 11 o'clock. So they all had to dash in different directions to find somewhere to watch that last final frame.
How nervous, like what happens to your body? What happens to your brain when you were getting down for that last shot?
Well, the last shot was a little bit easier than the one that Steve missed, really. But, I mean, there's no, you can't prepare for something like that. The pressure on both of us was unbelievable. And as I say, it was just mine was slightly easier than the one he missed. And it's great when I work with Steve. I do a lot of show. In fact, next year, as you mentioned, 40 years next year.
That's right.
We're doing about 30 or 40 shows all over the theatres, you know. And Steve is so funny. But when he talks about that, it's great to hear his views on how he felt. He said his legs, as he walked across the floor, his legs felt like somebody else's. And when he put his hand on the table, it felt like somebody else's when he tried to cut that black in. So the both of us were in quite a state, and I was the lucky one that knocked it in the end.
You're saying that last shot was relatively easy, but no shot is easy when there's so much at stake, right?
Well, yeah, that's in fact, that's what Steve said. The one he had to cut back, when you're under pressure, anybody that sort of has played a bit of game, you hit the shot too thick, and his brain's telling him, don't hit it thick, and he didn't hit it thick, he hit it too thin. So even for someone like him who was dominating the game throughout the 80s, the pressure was just, it was just immense on both of us, really, but it just showed that the great man, he suffered from the pressure as well.
I went down to the athletic stores in Belfast City Centre and bought a snooker cue after you won. And then I started playing snooker. My highest break, 89, sir. Not too bad.
I'll tell you what, that's you almost got to the century. Yeah, no, anybody that can get over 50, they can play a bit.
When did you hold your first snooker cue? How did you get into the game?
I was only 8 or 9. I was in Coal Island, and I was going up Plater's Hill, up past the police station. There was a club there, Jim Joe Gervin's Club, with two tables. And, of course, the door was open. I seen the balls whizzing around on the table, and it fascinated me. So I thought, I'd love to get in and watch the grown-ups. There was no alcohol or anything there, and I knew my brother went in. So that's how it started. That's how I got into the club. They let me sit and watch the grown-ups. I was a good little boy, held the rest for them, handed it to them when they needed it, and then they let me have a go on the table, and that's how it started.
Did you become quickly good?
At 14, I was the best in the area at billiards and snooker. We used to play quite a bit of billiards then. So, yeah, at 14, but even then, you never dreamt you were going to play snooker. I remember watching on a little black and white TV. They used to show it on Grandstand. They would have the Joe Davis and Fred Davis and Jackie Ray, who was from Northern Ireland. He was from Dungannon, Man. His son still lives up in Coal Island. Jackie was a great entertainer. And, I suppose I learned from watching them on the little black and white TV.
And at what point do you start thinking to yourself, this could be my job?
Well, when I started working in England, and I won the British Junior Billiards Championship when I was 17 and a half, and they brought me back to Coal Island to do an exhibition, and who turned up to play only the All-Ireland Amateur Snooker Champion, and it was Alex Higgins. And the first time I seen Alex, and I thought, this fella's something special. And sure enough, he came over to Blackburn, where I was based, and I practiced for nearly 2 years with Alex. So I learned a lot from Alex, and when he won the World Championship, I used to do well against him in practice. So I thought, well, listen, I might have a go at turning professional. And the year after Alex turned professional, I had a go. But he won it in 1972, which was quite an achievement.
What job did you leave? What were you doing before snooker?
At that time, when I went to England, I was working 12-hour shifts in a paper mill to earn a few quid. Then I got an office job because I was starting to practice a bit more. And in the end, I was managing a snooker club before I went full-time professional. And that was 1973-74. I gave him a job up managing the club and went off to Canada, paid my own way to play in the Canadian Open, and did well out there and got invited into Pot Black. And once you got on Pot Black, you were on the rung of the ladder, and I got to the final of Pot Black, and then I started getting a bit of work in.
You mentioned Alex, and I remember bringing Alex into the Nolan Live TV studio. We're going back many, many years. We're 10 years, well over 10 years ago now. Many, many years ago. Was he as eccentric at the beginning as towards the end, Dennis?
He was always, he was just a one-off character, Alex. You never knew what he was going to do. And, he lived around the Blackburn area for quite some time before he finished up in Manchester. But, he was just, let's put it, I very rarely, you didn't go out that often for a quiet drink with Alex. It wasn't easy to go for a quiet
drink. Did you ever have any loud drinks with Alex?
No, I'll tell you what, I would love to have one of the weekends when Alex used to go to Guernsey and spend the weekend with Oliver Reed. Now, that would have been quite a weekend.
What's it like behind the scenes in the world of snooker? What was it like in those days? Was there a camaraderie? Were there many friendships? How did that sit with the rivalry?
And there was lots of friendships because there wasn't that many professionals in the game. I mean, we used to go off to Australia, the Pop Black team, the 8 top players, and they were all, very friendly with each other. But once you got on the table, the rivalry went out the window. Cliff Thorburn, even to this day, is still my best friend. And I remember playing him in the World Championship and someone was over from Canada, a mate of his, and he couldn't understand how we were walking down to the venue together. He said, you can't be doing that with your opponent. But that's how the game was. And I suppose with certain players today, it's still the same. Probably wouldn't be as close because there's so many players nowadays. But there is still players that are close friends, but not on the snooker table.
What was the? I remember when I was a kid, the slow one used to do my head in. Terry Griffiths. What was he like behind the scenes? He had a big blonde coiffer. Was it Terry Griffiths? It was him. Was he the
Terry
one that was really
blonde,
slow?
Yeah,
and he was really slow.
He wasn't in exhibitions. I mean, Terry beat me in the final of the World Championship in 1979, and bless him, he's not that well at the moment, Terry.
Is he not? So, is he all right?
Yeah, he's got a bit of dementia, bless him, but he's he was a great, great player. And but there was him, Eddie Charlton, and Cliff Thorburn. There were
he was the grinder, right?
The grinder was, although a lot of the ladies loved watching Cliff, even though he was slow at the table. But listen, that's the beauty about the game of snooker. Back in the day, we had as many ladies watching snooker as men, and I think that trend has continued. And, it's great to see a mixed audience at all the different events.
Talking about slow, Steve Davis, I remember, used to do your head in, but he won every time in terms of slowness, in terms of the carefulness that he walked around that table. What was that? Was some of that deliberate to wind up his opponent or what?
Well, he wasn't slow, Steve, believe it or not. He was quite fluent when he got in amongst the balls. He just never missed. And the reason he was a bit boring is because he kept beating everybody. The players never thought he was boring. But Steve was he was so focused back in those days. He never mixed much with the other players, although...
Oh, did he not? Why not?
No, he kept himself a bit like Nick Faldo in the golf. And, he had to be, and that's why he dominated the game throughout the 80s. But when you work with Steve nowadays, he is one of the funniest men. He makes me laugh, even though we do lots of shows together every night. I work with him, he makes me laugh. He's so funny, and... I'm looking forward to going to the Dinardry tomorrow night with him. And, of course, John Virgo's there with us as well. So,
oh, brilliant.
It's going to bring back a few memories. We used to stay there when we played at the Antrim Forum. We used to do lots of shows there. So looking forward to getting back to the Dinardry tomorrow night. And John Virgo, well, there's another fellow who's very funny. He used to be on Big Break. So John compares the evening and gets a few people out to do a few trick shots. Steve and myself will play a couple of frames. We'll reenact that final black, and then we have a lot of fun with the audience for the remainder of the evening.
And Dennis, when you've been at the top, as you have, is it hard to always be looking back on it, or do you look back on it fondly now, or do you I suppose it'll be like myself when it's all over. I haven't exactly got to the top, but do you always want to be keeping on competing, or are you glad you've let it go?
Well, competing is tough. I retired and then I came back and played in the seniors for another 10 years. And then I retired again from the seniors 2 years ago. So to be doing the commentary, it's still wonderful to be involved in the game. But when we do these shows, you know, you wouldn't think Steve. I mean, Steve is quite busy with his DJing as well. There's at 66 years of age, he's playing Glastonbury as a DJ, and he's with a band as well, Steve. Brilliant. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
But we love doing the shows and reminiscing. I mean, the standard of snooker is not that great, but we still knock in the odd big break.
You're a legend from this place, and we look forward to seeing you in the Dunadry tomorrow night. And thank you so much for spending time with us on the programme this morning,
Stephen,
Dennis.
Stephen, it's always great to chat with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. Dennis Taylor. Now, one of the most historic and dramatic moments in Northern Ireland sport. We will hopefully reminisce about Dennis Taylor together. 030-30-80-55-55. 13 people, including a child, have been killed in an Israeli airstrike near the main government hospital in southern Beirut. The Lebanese Health Ministry said this earlier in the week. It was among 13 airstrikes that hit South Beirut on Monday night. I've been speaking to Adam Manet. Adam's cousin, Zaki, is being held hostage in Gaza. Zaki's eldest child, who had just turned 18, was shot dead in the attack. A warning, some of you may find this upsetting, as Adam told me about what happened to his family on October the 7th.
Well, on the morning of October 7th, rocket sirens started blaring at 6:29 a.m. And as unfortunately, it's a quite frequent occurrence in that area. And so the family rushed to the bomb shelter. The children already sleep in the bomb shelter as routine, just because you only have about 15 seconds to get to safety before a rocket hits you. The Iron Dome is fairly useless in that area as well because it doesn't have enough time to lock onto a rocket before it can land. And so they thought nothing of it, but then quite quickly they realized that this was a much bigger rocket attack than usual. And unfortunately, it has been a very usual occurrence, but this was much bigger. And quite quickly after that, they realized that intruders had gained access to the community in Nachaloz, which is about 600 meters away from the Gaza fence. And the terrorists had gained entry, and they had taken already killed a number of people. And they took a 17-year-old boy, one of the neighbors, at gunpoint, and frog marched him around the community and forced him under duress to try to lure out anybody hiding. And they heard him, Tomer, his name, and they heard him trying to lure them out, and they didn't come out. Eventually, the terrorists got frustrated, and they tried to gain entry to the bomb shelter, and my cousin Zaki was barricading the door. These shelters are designed for rockets, not for intruders, so it wasn't locked or heavily fortified door. And his eldest daughter, Mayan, who had just celebrated her 18th birthday only a few days earlier, the balloons from her party were still up in the house. She had decided to help him, and the two of them barricaded the door while Tzachi's wife, Gali, and his two smaller children, Shachar and Yael, 9 and 12, were behind them. Eventually, the terrorists got frustrated, and they shot through the door, and they shot Mayan in the head, killing her instantly. Tahi,
I'm sorry.
Watched his daughter die, and tried desperately to resuscitate her. He couldn't. Meanwhile, the terrorists had taken the rest of the family out into the sitting room, and they forced Gali to unlock her phone so that they could live stream the horror to the family, to her Facebook, so that the rest of the family could see the horror unfolding before their eyes. Tzachi was in shock, blood of his firstborn all over him. You can actually see that clip because it was one of the first clips or one of the earliest clips shared from the October 7th massacre. The whole world has seen my family and the horror that they faced. The children talking to the terrorists, desperately trying to explain why Shachar, the youngest, was crying so much because they wanted him to shut up. And his sister Yael, 12, at that time 11, She explained to them in English, "You killed his sister. That's why he's crying so much." And the terrorists respond in English, "She's with your God now." Eventually, the terrorists decide that the IDF were coming and they wanted some insurance, some collateral. So they took my cousin Tzachi, with the blood of his firstborn still all over his clothes and his legs and arms. And they frog marched him barefoot to Gaza with our neighbor, Omri, who has two small children, ages 1 and 3. And that was the last time we saw either of them.
We've heard day after day about the human misery, but my goodness, it remains harrowing. And you must have told that story a number of occasions, but it, my goodness,
yeah.
And now you're wondering if Zaki is alive. You just don't know.
We don't know. He's never been visited by the Red Cross. He's never been seen by a diplomat. He's never been seen by a doctor or a nurse. He's my age. He's 50 years old.
And he's not only, let's hope, being held hostage. Let's hope he's alive.
Absolutely.
But he's having to deal with that unbearable mental trauma that he of the... the images of his daughter.
Well, Stephen, we don't know, for example, that, I mean, for all he knows, he might be thinking that the rest of the family were murdered. We don't know what he knows. We don't know if he knows that his family are alive. We know that the last thought he had was seeing his daughter murdered in front of him, dying in his arms.
That's my point. That's my point. That's what he's, hopefully, if he's still alive, that's an unbearable position he's in.
The boy that they used to march around to try to lure the families out, Tomer, they murdered him. Once they were done with him, they shot him in the back of the head. They went around, they killed his father-in-law, they killed his mother. They took his two stepsisters hostage. They were released in the November deal. It was a massacre. And my family are homeless. They've lost their eldest daughter, and they've lost their father. They buried my aunt without Tzachi. The daughters, his children celebrated birthdays without him. We're desperate and afraid of what kind of horrors he's going through right now.
The people who did this, in order to have a chance of getting the hostages released, do you think a deal should be done with them?
We've always thought that a deal should be done, but the problem is that we've been talking about a deal for a year, and my cousin's life is in jeopardy. Another 100 other hostages, many of whom we know are already dead, but we still want to retrieve them, so that they can be buried and there can be some closure for the families. We want them home. And the world has insisted that everything has to be done through this deal, this magical deal where a fanatical death cult intent on murdering and killing as many Jews as possible, anybody even associated with us in some way. They've killed numerous other nationalities. They've killed, there were 26 nationalities that were victims of October 7th. There's a British citizen among the hostages, Emily Damari. You know, this deal is not going to transpire. We've waited a year for a deal. Hostages have been released on humanitarian grounds. And people need to stop treating the hostages as a bargaining chip. My cousin is not a bargaining chip. He's now been sat in a horror tunnel in Gaza somewhere, probably with very little air, food, water. We know that the last 6 hostages that were been recovered, who are now believed to have been the ones that were surrounding Yahya Sinwar, were found at half their usual body weight. Edin Yurul Shami, a 24-year-old young woman, was found weighing only 36 kilos. She should have been double that weight. They were starving to death. There were signs of torture. There were signs of abuse, neglect, and they were riddled with bullet holes. We know that the conditions that the hostages are facing is abhorrent. And every day that they remain there, their lives are in jeopardy. It's a humanitarian issue, not a political issue.
Well, and when you talk about humanitarianism and human beings, I understand how angry you must be. Is it right for Benjamin Netanyahu to bomb and kill innocent people?
Nobody innocent should die. But you have to understand that this is a war, and in war, innocents die. The way to end the war is to release the hostages and for Hamas to surrender.
But the
we're desperately calling for, right now, the leadership of Hamas are safely ensconced in the 5-star luxury hotels of Doha and Qatar. And our government and the United States and the world are bedazzled by the billions that have been pouring in from Qatar's wealth. The Qataris own the Shard, they own Harrods, they own a piece of Heathrow, they own some of Sainsbury's, they own football teams, they've hosted the World Cup. The entire world is being bedazzled by all the wealth and money from Qatar, while at the same time, Qatar is hosting this fanatical death cult and its leadership, many of whom are billionaires themselves, in the lap of luxury. So I ask you, why are we tolerating that? Why are we doing deals with Qatar? Why are we sending them fighter jets? The largest export market for the UK arms is Qatar, not Israel. Israel is not even in the top 10.
Can I come back, Adam, to Netanyahu? Because I've listened to I've listened to your understanding of humanity and the pain you've articulated really, really effectively. But that pain is no different from the people who are under rubble, the children, the innocent men and women who are blown apart by Netanyahu's bombs. Should he show more restraint? Or are people like you so angry? And please take this question with the intention that I mean it with, which is respect. Are people like you who have suffered so much pain, indescribable pain, when you know what's happening to people you love, are you desensitized to what is happening to innocent people who are also loved and are being blown apart by Netanyahu?
I mean, you keep saying that it's by Netanyahu, but who started this war? I mean, this is on Hamas. I mean,
but
Hamas.
Whoever started it, the massacre. But for those innocent people,
the massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, you can't just shrug that off and pretend like if this happened to the UK, the equivalent would be, you know, thousands more dead. You know, by population, if this happened in on UK soil, do you think we would just sit there and shrug and not respond in any way? Do you think that there's any way that the Israeli public would ever tolerate the existence of Hamas on its borders ever again? That it could feel safe and trusted that this genocidal death cult would be allowed to just exist next to us? So I never want to see innocent civilians die. But when you keep emphasizing that somehow this is Netanyahu's bombs, that's a misunderstanding of the conflict. The onus is on Hamas. If the world was united. If the international community, if the United Nations, if the UK government were united in condemnation of Hamas from the beginning, demanding the release of the hostages unconditionally, unequivocally, we would not be able to, we would not be having this conversation.
I hope Zaki comes home soon. I'm really grateful to you speaking to us. Thank you very much, Adam.
Thanks.
And best wishes. I hope you find Zaki soon.
Thanks very much, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. Sorry to Connor for being late today. He's coming up right now. See you in the morning.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.